attention.
Connie, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Very good. I think we've just gone live on Facebook. But before we start, a reminder for those listening on the podcast to subscribe and recommend the podcast to others. Most people find out about the Faster podcast by word of mouth, and your recommendation helps to spread the word, helps us to get more listeners. Hey, so Connie, welcome to the Faster podcast.
Thank you.
We've had some catch-ups on Facebook Live when we were down in Gavarati last and talking about some of the testing equipment that you use. But before we get into talking about biomechanics and rowing, maybe you could explain to the group what it is, what you do.
Okay, so welcome everyone, and thanks to Bill that he invited me to your podcast. Always great to listening in and see what other people have to share. So the way I came into biomechanics and rowing was pretty much from the start that I loved sport. I wanted to get more into the depths of understanding movement. So I studied sport science in Germany, and one of my favorite subjects was biomechanics. And just by chance, I thought at one stage, I really like to go to Australia. The Australian Institute of Sport at that stage became quite popular. So I applied for work experience and was lucky enough to get it. In the beginning, I was more interested in swimming because that was my background. But when I arrived there and did my swimming and later on, they were looking for somebody for rowing. I thought, oh, why not? I did row a little bit at university, never competitively. However, I do believe it doesn't matter where you come from as long as you have an interest for movement. And then I think biomechanics itself, it's also important that we don't see it just as one part of the sport science sections. For me, biomechanics is a part of an interdisciplinary approach within our sport, how we coach, how we train. And obviously, understanding technique efficiency and optimization is an area that has always interested me. I've listened to Tony Rice and Charlie, obviously. They are good colleagues and friends of mine as well. And it's really important that we see the person as a whole and also look into these different areas of what makes training strong. And obviously, it's the engine, it's the technique, it's awareness, it's what you eat. So nobody can work as one part by itself. It always has to become into a unit. And we are not robots. Yeah. So we need to understand the movement while getting your body filled and getting the engine strength. Yeah.
All the different elements of the system, right? So when you did your swimming piece, were you at the Institute of Sport?
Parts of it, yes. Part of that work experience was that I took on a project, and at that stage I took on it was getting more into race analysis. This was in 94. So at that stage, doing race analysis post the competition was a big thing, because at that stage they really found some parameters that helped athletes and coaches to understand, you know, where your strengths is during your racing, where you make time, where you lose time. So this was highly fascinating for me in the beginning of my career to step into that, because I could relate to that movement really well. Obviously, there are lots of parallels once you get into other sports, such as rowing, kayaking, cycling, where we also have said frequency movement.
Who was at the Institute at that time that probably influenced you and took you into rowing all full time?
Yes. The way it happened is that one of my biggest mentors was definitely Professor Dr. Bruce Mason. He was the head of the biomechanics department at the AIS, whilst Professor Dr. Hahn, who was mentioned by Tony Rice, he was the head of the physiology department. So in the beginning, Bruce obviously influenced me most and was a fantastic mentor for me, especially when I transferred to the rowing. But later on, also, I was guided a lot by Alan Hahn, especially when it came to facts of what is the difference between doing research and applied work. Because there is, as much as a lot of things run parallel and interact with each other, there is a different approach, yeah, of when you study something for a, for example, master's degree or PhD, or if you want to work on a daily basis with athletes and really look for that one percenter, but it has to be in an applied way. And what we always like to say is the information we gather with the athlete and the coach needs to be three things. It needs to be applied to the sport we are working with, needs to be coachable. So the parameters we choose, coaches need to be able to relate to, they need to be able to use them as a transfer tool for the athlete. And the information also needs to be trainable. Yeah. So the athlete needs to understand where they can make the difference. So it's quite a big difference to have a research project going to an applied daily project, yeah, or a daily monitoring.
Because I can imagine you've got a lot of data that you're looking at. And I know from working with you, it needs to be made very simple, at least for me to understand, to interpret what do those curves mean, making it applied and teachable and trainable. So if you go back to 94, that's when you were doing the project, 94 or 96?
94, and then started to work at the Institute in 96. So first I finished my master's with the information at the AIS.
So what were you looking at then, Connie? What were the things that you were specifically picking up that you were then passing on to the coaches in 94, 96? Because I'm guessing the telemetry wasn't so fantastic as it is today.
You will not believe it, but there was actually telemetry around at that stage. Even then, even we couldn't measure everything so easily like you can do these days. However, you could already do that live in rowing and also in other sports like swimming. And swimming, a big breakthrough at that stage was that they pretty much developed a system of how to analyze the not just the rowing stroke, but the racing profile. So how many meters do we want to consider for a start? So how, and then how you can actually practice start times. How much time is free swimming time versus turning times? And there is that fantastic story of Kieran Perkins, who was an Olympic gold medalist in the 1500 meters.
Amazing, amazing swimmer.
Yes. So anyway, that Bruce Mason, he was the one who pretty much figured out for Kieran and the coach that he was actually always gaining speed during the free swimming time, but he lost it in the turn. So obviously, once they figured that out, that this was a racing pattern he had developed, they, of course, took much more focus on how to teach turns, on how to make them more efficient and more precise, counting strokes, understanding the lengths of the strokes. So things like that, what is very common these days, that started to get a bit more of a, yeah, sort of structure, we could say. Yeah. So this was like one big project. At that stage, I also did a three-dimensional study with para rowers, which was a new thing as well, because para sports just came officially into the Olympic program. Again, it was amazing to work with athletes that have certain limitations, however, are amazing athletes. So you cannot just utilize your normal strategy of analyzing data. You just have to think a little bit more laterally of how, of what can actually make that particular athlete fast. So sometimes you have to work backwards, or because in the end, a lot of things are the same. You get measured by your key performance parameter, which is speed, same as in rowing. But then how do they, do the athletes with or without, you know, disabilities, make their speed? And then obviously you can have symmetry in your stroke or not, just depend. Yeah. So things like that become then very interesting. And I guess it's also where sometimes you go from gathering lots of data of many athletes, but the basic measures, or with other athletes, that actually we acquire more depth to make a next move. Yeah. If they have, for example, quite a unique disability, often you need to gather more data on just one athlete to actually understand technique. But I think the big thing is that it's not a one-sided approach. You always have to have that communication with the coach and the athlete. So yes, in this way, for me, sports science lives from communication, because otherwise I think we live in a gray zone and think we are approaching the right direction. But often if we don't listen to that voice of the athlete and the coach, we could actually work against each other. Yeah,
because you don't have the context.
Exactly. And often, I think, especially when we come sort of to a lot of the top athletes, sometimes you wonder how they make speed. And just to finding that little path here to rowing. If you think of last year's Olympic gold medal winner, the Greek single sculler, who would have thought that he will win the gold medal? A smaller person came from lightweight rowing, light, much smaller than a lot of the big single scullers who have been successful over the past few years. And then there is somebody coming in and using a totally different approach and is fast. So how does he do it? Yeah.
So how does he do it then, Connie? From what you've seen, what do you think he was doing differently to Chettleborg and Sverre Nielsen and Dummy Martin?
I guess one thing obviously is he has that amazing coach, Gianni Postiglione, who has been well known of making athletes from a lot of different countries fast, just by his way of, again, just thinking sometimes outside of the box, not seeing different anatometries or different height, sizes, width, arm lengths as a limitation. He sees it as a way of, okay, this is what you got given. You love the sport of rowing. I see that you can move a boat. Now let's move around the rocks and find the right pathway for you that makes you fast. So again, you could just say, okay, let's measure your ergometer test or do an ergometer test. Obviously, he would not be outstanding in comparison to others. Yeah. Maybe he would be when you look at the erg score versus his weight, the ratio. I don't know that. But obviously, once he comes into the boat, it's about how you move your hull. And they knew he was technically very good and his physiology was okay, but they needed to find a strategy between stroke rate to technical gains that made him fast. That was in the end a little bit his trick, yeah, of how to do it. Maybe the weather and a little bit of tailwind helped him, but this can't be all. Obviously, he has a good way of moving a boat without losing speed at the points where a boat can lose speed.
Okay. And where do you see as the main points where a boat loses?
The biggest point pretty much is when you're approaching the catch. So this is what we see with 90%+ of our crews, is that a lot of crews that maybe have power lose catch time or check time because the way they approach the last part of the recovery is not precise and not efficient enough. So if you think of all the different techniques we see around the world, starting from the junior or club rowers, we often see that athletes consider the rowing stroke with a little long stroke, because this is what they get taught, what we all talk about. Rowing needs to be a long stroke. So reaching out, often athletes think of reaching out by falling into the catch. It means falling into the stretcher. By doing that, you're losing your horizontal line towards the catch. And the moment you go down, your blade goes up. But if you imagine yourself in that tucked position at the catch, straight away, you would have that point where your legs cannot stand still, so they have to start moving, but your blade is still here. And this is often the biggest sort of, not a trick, but this is where often we give ourselves a disadvantage by not approaching the catch just a little bit more with care and a bit more precisely. Because the moment you have too much vertical difference by falling into the stretcher, your legs start moving before the blade's covered, and the beginning of your dry phase becomes reactive instead of active or proactive even. So this is where a boat naturally can lose a lot of speed. And this is where I would often say to athletes and crews I work with, try to do it the smart way, not the hard way. Because of our cyclical stroke pattern, once you fall into the habit, you will do that every stroke. So if you every stroke give a lot of water away, which others people also call catch slip or wasted catch, then every time you have to build up your speed again. And this can be quite tiring over 240 plus strokes. So just imagine if you're just that little bit more precise, more horizontal in your approach, straight away, you give your legs in that tucked position a bit more space, and the legs start automatically to work first or to push first. Blade at the same time is placed in the water, coordination works well, and you do that natural sequence of leg drive, body opening, arm drive.
Yes.
That's often the trick where we have boat movers versus boat pushers. Yeah.
Okay. So that's one of the things that you're seeing consistently to be corrected by crews.
Oh yeah, that's for sure. And again, it's not that people want to do it wrongly. It's just, if we think of our extensive training regime in rowing, and we want to get a lot of time and to get our endurance and strength up. So you put a lot of time in, you get tired. So what falls apart first when you get tired is mostly your technique. That's why it's a bit of a devil's circle. We want to be technically strong and precise. However, through fatigue, we fall into patterns. And these patterns, especially on the water, guide us towards wrong coordination, which then causes more drag than we actually need to create for our boat.
The devil's circle, or a vicious cycle, that goes down. How about that? I'm a blowfly in the room here with me, joining in. Hey, how about at the finish of the stroke, Connie? We see a lot of crews laying back, the heavy layback from the Canadians, as you see some of the scullers also. In the Olympic final, we're lying back versus someone sitting very tall. What are your thoughts on the different technique and the actual biomechanical impact?
Yeah, obviously the finish also is a very critical part of where we can hover and sort of lose speed instead of continuing gaining speed. Again, as you say, there are different types of techniques around, and often we like to look at some more than others, and people like to copy. But I always say to coach and athlete, if you want to copy something, don't just copy what, because you always have to think through why can certain crews be successful with that technique. So if we think of athletes going really far back, This is really that open hip angle is not the natural angle for a human body. So it requires an immense amount of core stability if you want to do that properly. Yeah. The other thing too is if you lean so far back, you have to be very careful that you still stay in contact with the stretcher. Otherwise, you are losing your only fixed point in the boat. And this can be actually quite fragile. So again,
what do you mean by fragile? Sorry.
Fragile is the moment our athletes lose a stretcher, they cannot.
They are no longer connected to the foot plate.
That's right. Yeah. So what it does is you can't really move yourself easily forward anymore. Yeah. Because you want to stay connected and then tap down, hands away, and then you can move forward. So it's a bit of a natural pattern there. Yeah. But if you lose contact to the stretcher, often your hips can't hold it because the core isn't strong enough and your hips would fall backwards. And then you create an extra movement, like a little signature when people shorten up or round their backs to just try to move themselves forward. And this is because they lost pretty much that contact to the stretcher, yeah, to bring themselves forward again in a sort of nice, efficient way. Want to be, again, finished, tap down, hands away. Obviously, there are different ways of how people want to do it. As we know, some people always ask, what is it with flowing hands or stop? Again, when people talk about that, stopping movement around the finish, make sure that you actually check the crews who do that at low rate. They actually, it's more, they hover and it looks differently. Once they go up to the higher rate, they are not stopping anymore. We've done quite a bit of studies there. Once they are over a certain rate, they can't stop there either anymore because your time in drive to recovery is you haven't got time to stay there in that movement and be slow off the back.
Connie, we're seeing a lot more high rating in the last few years. It's probably similar to the late 80s, early 90s. There was a lot of high rating as well. In your mind, from what you've seen, in your opinion, what is the big deal there with the higher rating? Lighter rigging versus maybe a heavier rig, lower rating. What are the pluses and minuses for either? And what do you think is the most effective ratio?
Coming first to the point of higher rating, it was actually quite interesting because when you thought from 16 up to 20, there was a tendency and a big trend that it looked like crews were rating higher and higher. And not just in one boat class, but in a few. However, when you actually look at some of the successful ones in during the Olympics, the rating hasn't really gone up. Some of them actually brought the rating down. So obviously, this is also a bit of a preference. If you can rate lower, then, and you can be efficient and gain your speed, of course, it's from a physiological point, much less draining, yeah, on the body. Also talking about the rigging, same thing. I think I have the big advantage that I used to work once where I gained my foundation of rowing and also the understanding of biomechanics rowing and what works versus the coaching of rowing. I really, it's a big sort of thank you what I was able to gain there on knowledge while I was working with the Australian Institute of Sport and also with Rowing Australia for many years. And then in 2014, I started to work with different federations and independently, and I gained a lot of insight also how other countries, how other university, college programs, junior programs, master's program, how everyone approaches training or coaching. And suddenly your world becomes very open and you don't have that sort of one view anymore of how should you coach? How should you set up your boat? How should you rig and how should you rate? Suddenly there are 100 plus coaches with so many different ideas. And then you look at the crews in the final and you think, okay, I've worked with three or four of them and everyone has a different rig. And then they can be successful, all of them, and the idea of rigging can be totally different. And I think that's a fascinating part for me to actually see again that your coaching approach with the athlete and then your consideration of what rigging fits can be quite different. It's like training methodology. I'm sure like you had quite a few speakers already there on your podcast and some of them had quite different ideas. And that's how the same thing is with training and with rigging. If I guess when we think of the big sort of sweep aids and the rigging is quite similar between the boats. But when I think of sculling, they are from quite heavy to very light and they are all on the podium. And so it's, there is no one fits all method. So if people want to go, what's the best rigging? I would always say, start with a standard and see how it goes because the actual standard rig cannot be your limiting factor for you rowing. It will be most likely the technique use, yeah, or you are able to row. So yeah, I can't give you a total answer always on the rigging. Because for me, it became more individualized the more people I've worked with. And yeah, so it's...
How do we start to individualize it? If we're looking at a crew where there's one tall person and someone that's a bit shorter, what kind of strategies would you advise people to think about when they're setting their boat up? There's near 190 and the other person's 180 centimeters tall.
I guess the best thing is... Obviously, there are standard rigs and they have been reported. There are so many information out there what has empirically worked for the level and boat class people row at. So I would always start there. However, then you, of course, have to make it a little bit individualized for your athletes. So if you have these different height differences, first thing, I would actually look how they are rowing and how they gain length. Yeah. Because we always know there is a mechanical length of what our athletes are able to go to from a catch to the finish and how they range. And obviously then you have to make sure that the blades go in very similar at the catch or the finish angles. So we always say 3 degrees difference. That's not a huge sort of disadvantage within a crew, neither on sculling on either side, nor on the sweep when you think from one athlete to the other. But obviously there are certain angles at the catch and at the finish we know that work and others become too short. So everything under 30 degrees at the finish position becomes quite hard to release the blade. So what I would do is pretty much measure out where you want your athlete to sit, that they reach the angle. So if you say, for example, woman sweep, you would like to have approximately 56 degrees at the catch and 32 at the finish. That's an overall arc of 88 degrees. So you mark that for your athlete. And then obviously, if you have different heights, you maybe have to change their stretcher in the beginning, or if needed, maybe you have to give them a little bit of a different inboard. Yeah. Or maybe even span sometimes can be more successful, or you gain quicker a change than in the inboard, but you have to see what works. Yeah. So again, yeah, obviously bigger athletes or taller athletes can go for wider spans sometimes, but this is not necessary the same in crew boats, yeah, because we want to keep them pretty much similar in the same sort of internal working frame within the boat. But if you have an athlete that has short arms and is quite tight around the hips, then often we would also say, why don't we just keep the same rigging load, but bring the span in? And that gives you a little bit more free range of finding a longer arc.
And Connie, how do you like to have the crews set up? Do you recommend they set up from the finish or the catch? So if they're getting together in the boat and they have to move foot stretchers and change, get the symmetry and the angles of the blades, where do you prefer that from?
Again, so I personally like it off the back. I quite like that we have very similar finish angles. And because I think empirically we see that the crews often find it easier to find the right, the same timing off the back. So you cover then the same arrival point and the hands away point. So you have quite a solid movement around that finish posture guiding into the recovery without many disturbances. Yeah, because you don't want to lose any speed at the moment when you have that free run in the recovery towards the catch. Saying that, there are quite a lot of coaches who also like to do it off the catch. I understand why they sometimes like it, especially in big boats, but my personal preference would be more of the finish. Yeah. But sometimes you also have athletes who are short on either end. So then you have to make a little bit of a choice of, are we going for a different rig for that person? And then again, which end would be better for him to change or her? And vice versa, if rigging is not just gaining length, rigging is also keeping athletes in time. Yeah? So then, yeah, I think it's, again, personally, I like it off the back. However, there are also circumstances where we maybe have to do it off the front because the way some athletes like to row that finish. You have some athletes who just do not like to have that tight finish, or they really like to row really far back and they maybe gain something from it, which can be quite a sort of positive factor in towards that boat speed. Yeah. I think that's where you come to that 90-10 rule a little bit. To 90%, everyone will fit into one sort of example that fits, but for some, you just have...
Some you need to make an adjustment. So you're advising a lot of international crews, and you did leading up to Tokyo and also Rio and your history with the Australian Institute of Sport. We'll go into some of the telemetry you use and some of the equipment, but what are you looking at in the data when you're being asked by coaches? What are they actually asking you with advising on where athletes should sit or changing the crew position? What are you looking for in the data and how are you explaining that to the coaches?
In general, it's of course fantastic that you can look at information sometimes in real time. But I would always advise coaches that there is a difference of looking into monitoring information or data where you do an assessment with athletes. Because if you just do a session, 20Ks and tap along, that's a very different approach by our athletes than when they have to perform and they are a bit more structured and push 100% through a piece. Because that will depend on what power or performance you are expecting of the individual versus the crew performance. So the advice would be, because it can go in so many directions, if you work by yourself as a coach and you like to use telemetry, I always would recommend that you look for 1 to 2 parameters you can handle to look at while you are on the water, because there is always that balance between utilizing your eye and doing your visual coaching versus comparing that with your objective data you would see on the screen. If you feel like you are looking too much on the screen, then obviously your actual quality coaching would go down. If you have somebody with you while you keep an eye on the crew versus the other one sort of guides you of what he sees on the screen, then obviously it's good for checking out how consistent at all. First, stroke lengths and setup. Are our athletes sitting at similar angles and moving at a similar time with each other? So you cover this displacement, like an angles, catch angle, finish angle, maybe also the waisted catch and finish slips. And obviously you also look at power. This is just from the numbers. However, power for me is just a resultant of the actual application of the technique the athlete is capable of doing. So possible, it's always good to combine your numerical measures or results you get from the information from the telemetry versus make sure you also consider the actual technical application of what the athlete is able to do. And then, as we said, so you have your parameters that are related to length and position. You've got your technical parameters. And then is an additional parameter, and this is stroke rate. Because what we always have to consider is that our technique looks always pretty strong at stroke rate 18, 20. The moment we pass stroke rate 28, that's where our athletes normally start to show some weaknesses in their technique. Yeah. And it's not weakness, but an area within their stroke that is not the strongest subpart of that drive phase, yeah, or the recovery phase. So that's why when we want to consider technique properly, we need to consider base rowing or base stroke rate rowing versus sub 30 rate rowing. And then you also need to raise pace. Otherwise, you can mislead your eye quite a bit by just thinking, oh, look how nice my athlete is rowing at rate 20. And quite a few athletes find it challenging to continue or to maintain that actual technique up when the rate is increasing.
Interesting. And for the coaches out there that don't have your sophisticated equipment, what do you recommend we use if we're putting a double skull or a club quad out on the water from an equipment perspective, so we can start to look at these parameters?
I guess we always have to start with the key parameter, which is your speed. So you want to have, you look at the speed at different stroke rates. And I think that is ingrained in coaching, especially in rowing coaching. So it's not much of a advice because coaches would do that anyway. I guess it's very important that you also check the blade displacement. So what angles are my athletes achieving?
Mm-hmm.
And video is always a fantastic tool to use. And if you don't have any measures, like any measuring tools to do that, why don't you mark yourself the appropriate angles your athletes need to or should be able to achieve? Put a little marker there. So when you are actually rowing, you can actually see, is my athlete reaching that marker as I, or in a way I've set them up? And then what is actually happening when the rate goes up? And you don't need big measuring tools for that because your eye helps you to see it on the video. And that's a pretty cool feedback tool already. Moving up from the blades, so we set the speed, the blades, obviously you should always have a look also how the bodies move, how the timing is of the blades of the bodies, and look also at that vertical displacement, as I mentioned. So you can do a lot through your video there already, or take some measurements, as we said, preset some angles. If you do notice that the stroke length shortens when the rate goes up, there is this good old straw trick where you put little straws on either end and set up some visual feedback points for your athlete, or you could also call it kinesthetic feedback, because the moment they would hit the straw, they get a feedback, I've got the length now I'm supposed to reach. That's always a nice, simple tool, works all the time. And I also have a big look always at the bodies of just checking where the hips are, because I often see athletes coming forward like that to try to reach, and the hip never actually rocks over early enough in the recovery. So in this case, also the hips for me have highly important focus point when I do some assessment with the athlete or try to guide them, because I think if we can do a proper rock over, I can actually reach that catch connection in a very natural way. But then we have a lot of growing bodies, especially young athletes, a lot of male athletes, where they grow so quickly at one part of their use, where the bone structure actually grows quicker than the muscles can keep up. And then we don't have to wonder that we have quite stiff athletes, because the muscle is now not keeping up with the length of the bone. And then, of course, we have trouble to get our athletes into the position. So that's where sometimes you need to help your athlete to find more vertical space by maybe allowing them to move the feet down or the seat up, just to reteach this sort of new longer body now to lengthen, give the muscle time to lengthen again, to reach that natural rock over position again.
Connie, is there any new technology that you're currently looking at or using that you would recommend that people buy?
Not really. I guess there are always little ones around that people bring new GPS units out, but they are not really. I'm working with some of them currently just to get the rowing specific software correctly, because that's always a hard thing. And that's why we don't see so many developments in rowing, because the rowing specific stroke is not as easy to analyze as a lot of other sports. And I think that's why we often struggle to find good feedback tools on the open market. We see it more with people like myself, or people who come from rowing and then develop little tools. Yeah. But in the open market where you say, oh, for triathlon, I can use ABC different X number of devices. This is a bit hard for rowing. I guess we have to capture that a little bit differently. If you're looking for tools for rowing, it depends what you are aiming for. So as we said, GPS units obviously are very helpful for us to understand speed, distance, our athletes row, and if you are lucky, also finding analysis tools that explain the intra-stroke boat acceleration in a way, because it helps us to understand the structure of our stroke. So how much time do we accelerate our hull in the boat, our hull during a stroke? How much of our time per stroke cycle do we decelerate our boat? So tools like that are, of course, fantastic. So they are boat related. Then you can, as we said, also have supporting tools. And we talked about the strollers. There are different companies who offer these little angles you can attach to the pins. They're set in Bioro, but there are also other companies doing it.
How about the Empower Gate? That gives you angles and...
Okay, so the Empower Gate, yeah, it has been around for quite a few years now. It's well established. I think it's a great tool because it gives coaches and people who love to have more objective feedback during training, it gives you that real-time feedback people are longing for. What you get in other sports so easily is finally there with something like this Empower Gates. Obviously, there are the little tricky thing with Empower Gates is that you cannot easily synchronize the gates that for the right and left side, or if you have more than one role. So you get the individual information instantaneously, but post analysis takes a little longer. So then you have, I use a Peach system. The Peach system does it a little bit differently. And also that system that time synchronizes every parameter they measure. Yes, you pay a little bit more, but it's always what you, which approach do you take? Mm-hmm. Yeah. They now do have also a visual online or real-time feedback tool, which they haven't had for many years. This is where the Empower Gate became very popular because that's what they did offer. Yeah. So for monitoring purposes, the Empower Gate was great. But putting it out here straight away is if we just talk about Empower Gates, the Peach Gates, and the Bioro Gates from Val Kleshnev, you have three systems and they all measure forces and power differently. That's so awesome. If you want to compare your power from one system to the other, I get sometimes coaches who just cannot understand why they are suddenly so different. How can it be that my athlete has been so consistent at rate 20 and at rate 32 for so many years? And since we've got the other two, the other system, for example, switching from Peach to Empower or Logs or vice versa, the numbers don't fit anymore. The angles don't fit anymore. Then I always have to say, you need to be very clear that when you have a system or you want to buy a system, make sure that you also use the recommended target tables that we offer. Obviously, NK has brought out one sort of empirical table of what to expect for the different ranges of athletes at different levels of rowing from junior up to elite. And so that's a very different table than what we use for the Peach system, because the forces get measured differently, get calculated differently when we talk about power. And that's where the differences come in. So has nothing to do with your athlete. It's just different approaches, different methods of calculating power, yeah, and angle. It's a complicated thing in rowing, I guess.
It is. It is. There's so much science that goes on behind what you do and how you simplify it for coaches. It's amazing. Connie, what is it that you've seen over the last couple of decades with highly successful rowers? What do you think they do consistently to be so successful that others don't do? What is it that you're seeing?
I guess we have... When we talk about a lot of gifted athletes, obviously we say they are gifted for a certain reason. They just have something that others can't reach. Yeah. They've got the right combination of technical skill level with the right engine and the right anthro, have maybe good levers. However, as we said, there are always the odd ones, like, for example, last year, the Greek scholar. Yeah. So he obviously had a good boat feeling as well. I guess what they do is they approach to training is maybe something we, as much as we don't want to hear it, they take training very seriously. So if I think of people like Kim Brennan, for example, what I always admired was that after every training session, it could be 20 kilometers or any speed sessions, but pretty much every session finished with, I think, 5 little starts or 5 times 5 to 10 strokes of a higher rate. And the idea here was by her and her coach, Lyle McCarthy, was always that he wanted to get that neuromuscular system firing, because you have to teach your muscles what you are aiming for when the rate goes up. So it's just a few strokes, but it just helps your body to get the awareness of what you need. And within these few strokes, it's not just that you're teaching yourself the balance of the boat. It also teaches you, do you actually need to do something a little bit more in training to maybe become more flexible, technically a bit more aware? So you don't get surprised. That's what I really want to say. Even under, I don't know where, and it was a funny noise, sorry. So that was one thing that I have seen that with other federations too. They just do at the end of every session, just a few strokes of higher rate, which I think that's, I really like that, yeah? Just to teach that neuromuscular system properly. The other approach, what I heard recently that impressed me, was by Eric Murray, for example, while he was giving a talk to some coaches. And he said for him, it was very simple, his training, in a way of he wanted to see the objective information that got gathered. Because obviously, when he trained, they measured so many things, but some athletes just don't want to see, especially the results of training sessions where they maybe were tired and they didn't look their best. But this is what Eric Murray said. This was for him the best teaching method of all. He said, I didn't actually care when I went well. I actually wanted to know when I didn't go so well for certain reasons, to really figure out where it happened, because then I can make a difference. Just that open approach of finding that mistake and actually being happy that you made one and the results showed it. So I guess the good athletes don't get so flustered by a training session that doesn't go 100%, because they just take it as it's just one session of so many.
Mm. Yep. Yeah, it's a real growth mindset. They're looking at data objectively. They're seeing how they can improve, not taking it personally.
Yeah, and then maybe doing that 1 kilometer a little bit more per training session, or doing that little approach that maybe hurts or burns a little bit. But this is sometimes what you have to do, putting extra time into your stretching, because you know that your rowing position in the boat is not quite the right motion to become the most flexible person.
Yeah.
Or other athletes, I think we also have a lot of success where athletes come also from different sports, or even though they are tired after rowing, still love to do other types of motion. It's not about training, but it's riding their bike home, or playing some other sports with their friends, let it be a team sport. Just making sure that you A, have fun in what you do, but also keeping your body robust. So it's with everything. If you just teach one method, if you just teach one motion, you make your body fragile. If you bring some other type of off-water training in or movement, your body becomes much more robust and light, just creating lightness in the body. Yeah. And the last word, sorry, Bill, is I guess that's what our sport is not doing 100% well, and other sports do much more, creating little challenges in the boat. We always want to have flat water. But if you think of swimming or running or sport that relate a little bit to that cyclic motion of what rowing has as well, a lot of sports create different external challenges athletes have to learn to deal with. Let it be waves, let it be extra wind, let it be different weather conditions, or suddenly a speedboat comes through and you actually need to learn to row through it. So things like that are important. You cannot just keep lab conditions for our athletes because they do not exist in rowing.
Certainly not at the Olympics, huh?
No. But
so, Connie, what are some of the books that you would recommend our listeners go out and find and read to learn more about rowing?
Obviously, the ones that I quite like are the ones that also have a little bit of technical background. I do really like the book here by Kleshnev, so Rowing Biomechanics. So I always think that's a fantastic book he put together there. Maybe some things are a little bit harder to understand than others, but again, you don't need to read the book from the front to the end. It's a guide where you can pick the chapters that actually are of interest for you at that point in time. I do the book, the Volkanolti books. I think the faster rowings are fantastic. And I do like them, coming back to the beginning of our talk, because it has that multidisciplinary approach where you actually hear different people talking about rowing, let it be from applied science or physiology or dietitians. So that mixture of what makes that entire rowing training, what supports a rowing training in a daily life. There is another book, I don't know how popular that is already, but it's one of my favorites. And this is, I think it's called The Handbook of Rowing Training. And it came out by three German coaches, Altenberg, Mattes, and Steinacker. And Professor Mattes was one of my big mentors as well. It was translated from German to English. But I always think that's actually a fantastic book, because sometimes, and I see that again and again, we often just grab English literature because this is what we are used to. But we should never forget that there are fantastic ideas out there, where a lot of people have also written fantastic ideas down in different languages that haven't maybe been translated. But if you get hold of it, and these days it's quite easy to translate some of it, I think we could gain so much more knowledge by being a little bit more open of what else is out there in the non-English literature. Yeah, that's what I often do, is sometimes just looking what else is out there. And you are often surprised, because sometimes we are just scratching on the surface, just searching for English literature.
Yeah, that's fair. If you only speak English, that's what you look for. You're multiple.
Yeah, but yeah, it's, yeah, I only have one language more. But I think that is, and it's not just that I'm looking into the German literature. There's a lot in the French literature and the Spanish literature. Yeah. Just as a sort of common point, I often, or the Russian literature too, obviously a lot of stuff came out there as well. I often just like to say that we just have to sometimes look a little bit around and not just see what's in front of us. That's all.
Exactly. And finally, is there anything I haven't asked you that perhaps we should cover? I know you've got you're working hard on a book.
That's right. Yeah. I also work on a book with Paul Thompson. So that will be hopefully out soon. Again, it's not done yet, so it's hard to talk about. But the big message is always rowing is a fantastic sport to analyze. And it's quite, in one way, easy to analyze. But I think it's also a sport where we love to overanalyze, especially when it comes to rigging. And when we come to just finding the right applied training. And I would just say, always follow a little bit your gut feeling. Also make sure that technique is your limiting factor if you're looking for speed, beside obviously also the engine. But don't just look for the little things in rigging. Just check at the big obvious points first, because technique, like if we look into how can we gain more speed for the boat, just look at your video and figure out, is there actually something technically I can change before you fiddle too much around with a rig? Because these gains are often so small in relation of what you can do technically by yourself. I think that's a big thing. And then also, I guess a big message, as much as row power relates to speed in our sport, we have lots of examples where we have efficient athletes that maybe are lower in their power per stroke, however, get much faster speeds. So don't underestimate your boat movers. And before you judge athletes too much by their power, maybe look through seat racing or through training by swapping athletes. Maybe figure out why some athletes move your boat in a crew and others don't. And the ones who don't, try to teach them and find out where the crucial points are that makes a boat stop. Yeah.
Great advice. So where can people find you? You're coaching or you're advising international teams, universities. So how do people best get in touch with you if they want to work with Dr. Connie Draper?
Okay. I pretty much get contacted through LinkedIn or word by mouth mostly. I haven't got the website because I'm working more with the teams I have known or people recommend me. So yeah, pretty much through recommendation, but I'm very open that people approach me through my email address or through the LinkedIn account. You definitely hear back from me. I'm always fascinated by working with new rowers, new teams, because you learn from everyone. So yeah, just biggest thing is email or via LinkedIn.
I'll put your LinkedIn details in the podcast show notes then so people can get in touch with you. Connie, it's been a fantastic chatting with you again. Thank you very much for your time. I look forward to when your book comes out. When do you think that will be with Paul Thompson?
Later this year.
Later this year. Be good for a Christmas present then.
So let's, but again, that the approach is there. Science of art of rowing in a way of we need to understand the coaching. The modern coaching versus the numbers, and what do we get out of it from both sides? What do we know works empirically through the real coaching versus where can objective feedback assist coaches and athletes to make that next step towards speed gains?
Maybe we can get yourself and Paul on the podcast when it comes to.
That would be fun, wouldn't
it? Yeah. Connie, thank you very much for your time. Hang on a minute. We'll stop the live stream now.
Okay, thank you.
Join me next time when I'll be talking with one of the rowing world's most interesting people,
And if you like this episode, you can subscribe so you never miss an episode in the future. Oh, and please, if you like it, leave us a 5-star review. That really helps us out. You can find out more about our unique training system and high-performance coaching by visiting whchambers.com.